inside, putting on helmets, masks, and goggles. At New York's Fordham University, protesters chanted and waved Palestinian flags. Under heavy police presence, more than 1,500 protesters have been arrested at colleges across the U.S. In the latest incident, 20 protesters were arrested at University of Texas, Dallas. Police have been accused of using brute force against demonstrators. The protest started in Columbia University on April 18th and has since spread nationwide. The protesting students demand university authorities divest from companies that have connections, ties, and nexus with the Israeli military. Well, student protests against the Israeli genocide in Gaza have been sweeping U.S. university campuses. We discuss the implications of this remarkable development with Chanda Barakat, who is a spokesperson for the Masar Badil movement.
The student uprising have a very clear and simple demands, really, because the student movement have consensus, especially those who are organizing these demonstrations and encampments, and that is they don't want their universities to invest in Israeli war crimes and genocide against the Palestinian people. They want their universities to be transparent in terms of their investment, and they want amnesty for all students who have been punished because they voice their objection to Israeli war crimes and genocide in Gaza. We must always remind people that the funds, the money, the support that the United States provide for Israel comes from the pockets of the American workers, of the American students, of people in the United States. And people are sick and tired of seeing Israel getting away with all these war crimes because of U.S. support. We must also remind ourselves that we are talking about a new generation that is have no loyalty to the Zionist media. They don't believe the Zionist and racist media. They don't look for information or news in places like Fox News or CNN. They actually understand very well that this is a media that has been utilized to justify Israeli crimes and U.S. policies. And they are actually planting fear in the hearts and minds of the Zionist regime and the Zionist leadership.
Palestinians, mostly children and young people, have gathered in the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah carrying banners to thank students worldwide, including in the U.S., for standing in their support. Let's listen to the reaction of some of the demonstrators in Gaza.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm here only to focus on one thing, which is the humanity. As a human being, all of us has the right to live under this humanity. Also, I would like to thank English students and academic students around the world. Since I am an academic here in Gaza Strip, I know the voice of academic people. Thank you very much indeed for contributing in making our voice audible. Thank you very much indeed for sharing our voice around the world. I recommend you to go more and more, to continue more and more, because I believe in the rights of academics. I believe in the rights of the human beings. Also, I believe that knowledge wins. Knowledge always at the end wins.
We are here to thank you for standing with Gaza during these tough times. Your support shows that caring and kindness can go beyond the border. Your voices are making a real difference. Your support is incredible. Your commitment to the humanitarian values and your dedication to make a real difference in the world are truly inspiring.
A Muslim civil rights and advocacy group, the Council on American Islamic Relations, has censured U.S. lawmakers for approving a bill aimed at criminalizing any criticism of Israel. The Council's criticism came after the so-called Anti-Semitism Awareness Act passed the U.S. House of Representatives by a wide margin on Wednesday. The Republican-led measure that equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism would smear Israel's critics amid the war on Gaza. The advocacy group says the bill is aimed at stifling the voice of American students advocating for Palestinian human rights. The bill was tabled at the time when several universities have been the scene of anti-Israel protests over the regime's genocidal campaign in Gaza. Well, it's day 209 of the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The regime continues to massacre civilians by pounding the blockaded territory with airstrikes and artillery fire. In the latest attack, one person was killed and five others injured after their house was shelled in the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. A woman was killed in a similar attack in the southern Gaza city of Al-Fukhari. In northern Gaza, Israeli warplanes struck a house in the Jabalia refugee camp. The regime also bombarded the electricity distribution company in the central city of Deir al-Balah. Since the onset of the Israeli war last October, nearly 34,570 Gazans have been killed, most of them women and children. However, the actual death toll is believed to be much higher, as thousands remain under the rubble. The death toll is in addition to more than 77,700 people who have been injured. Nearly 7 months of Israeli bombing and shelling campaign has not only turned a large part of Gaza into the rubble, but has decimated its healthcare system. Israeli restrictions on goods are also preventing life-saving medical supplies from reaching the few remaining hospitals. Two Palestinian mothers and a nursing director at Kamal Adwan Hospital explain their struggles.
We were struck. My son, as you can see, sustained severe burns, and I've been injured in the abdomen and both arms. My son was admitted to the intensive care unit at Kamal Adwan Hospital. If the hospital runs out of fuel, electricity will go out and my son will be cut off from oxygen and will lose his life. I call on the world to transfer my son for treatment abroad. He is in a very bad condition.
We were injured a month and a half ago, and there is no treatment available for us in Gaza, especially for our eyes. They only provide basic care for our wounds, and there are no eye surgeries available in Gaza. God willing, we hope to seek treatment abroad to regain our normal lives. My daughter and I need eye surgeries. There is no equipment in Gaza. There are no doctors. Most of them went south, and others were martyred.
If diesel in sufficient and continuous quantities does not arrive in a timely manner, work in the complex will stop, services will cease, and we will risk losing all the lives dependent on ventilators in the ICU, incubators, and during operations.
An international human rights organization has condemned Israel for deliberate militarization of public places, including schools and other educational facilities in Gaza. Euromed Human Rights Monitor says it has evidence that Israel has turned several schools across the territory into military bases and detention centers. According to the rights organization, one such facility was Salah Ad-Din School in Gaza City, which was converted by Israeli forces into a detention center for hundreds of locals. Euromed has also received testimonies revealing Israeli forces have carried out field executions, killing Palestinian civilians inside the same schools where they had sought refuge. The organization condemned the move as a violation of international humanitarian law, saying such facilities are meant to protect civilians during any military operation. Last March, about 100 leading European academics condemned Israel's genocide in Gaza, including the systematic destruction of the territory's education system. And concurrent with ongoing genocide in Gaza, Israeli forces have conducted fresh raids on different areas across the occupied West Bank as well. Our correspondent Mona Kandil joins us now from Ramallah with more details. Mona, what do you have to share with us with regards to the recent Israeli aggression across the West Bank?
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, this morning the Israeli forces raided several areas across the occupied West Bank, some of the occupied West Bank, the central areas, and all of the occupied West Bank, and the soldiers have detained at least 15 Palestinians. This is what the Palestinian Prisoners Society has documented. The Israeli forces stormed the town of Izna, West Al-Khalil, and detained the three Palestinians. In Al-Khalil, the Israeli soldiers also stormed the village of Beit Umar. In Beit Lahem, the Israeli troops stormed the Hashir refugee camp, as well as the town of Hussein. A number of Palestinians had been arrested there as well. Here in areas close to the city of Ramallah, the Israeli forces stormed Al Janazon refugee camp. The soldiers destroyed vehicles there and arrested a number of Palestinians, including at least one girl there. The Israeli forces had stormed the refugee camp of Al Amhari, southern the city of Ramallah, and the clashes have taken place between Palestinians and Israeli forces, specifically stone throwers, the residents of the refugee camp of Al Amhari. Israeli forces had also stormed the villages of Beit Sira, Budras, near Ramallah as well. In northern the occupied West Bank, this time the Israeli forces had stormed the city of Qalqilia, as well as the city, the town of Kufr Kalil, near Nablus, and the town of Rujib, southeast Nablus. And a number of Palestinians have been detained in these areas. The total number of those Palestinians who had been arrested since the genocidal war on the Gaza Strip had started back in October 2023, today is over 8,550 Palestinians. We have to mention that, unfortunately, over 10,000 Palestinians are being held in Israeli jails in very difficult situation. In addition to the daily raids, we have to mention that the Israeli forces have destroyed a three-story building, residential building, in the town of Hizma near Al-Quds. The Israelis claim this building had not get the construction building, the building permits or construction permits from the Israeli authorities, and that's why they destroyed it. Yesterday, as well, in the area of As-Sal'a neighborhood in Jabal al-Mukabbar in Al-Quds, also residential homes had been destroyed by the Israelis, as well as in the occupied West Bank, a two-story building had been destroyed, agricultural lands had been razed, and this time the Israelis want to expand the illegal settlement of Bani Haifa, and they are doing their utmost to force the Palestinians from the area of Khirbet, Khillet al-Furan in Al-Khalil, East Al-Khalil, out of from their lands in order to expand the illegal settlements there.
Thanks a lot, Mona Candiel, joining us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Elsewhere, Iran has imposed sanctions on certain U.S. individuals and entities over their role in Israel's crimes in the West Asia region. The foreign ministry announced the new curbs, saying they are in line with Iranian law called Countering Human Rights Violations and Adventurous and Terrorist Acts of the United States in the region. The ministry said the sanctions target those who are involved in Israeli terrorism and violation of human rights, especially Palestinians in Gaza. The sanctions cover five entities and seven individuals for providing weapons, money, and other assistance to Israel. The blacklisted entities include arms and ammunition manufacturing corporations such as Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Skidio, Chevron, and Karan. Several former and incumbent figures are on Iran's sanctions list for their role in Israeli atrocities. Well, the president of Colombia says his country will sever diplomatic ties with Israel over its genocidal war in the Gaza Strip.
We cut diplomatic ties with Israel because they have a genocidal president. I believe that today all humanity in the streets by the millions agrees with us and we agree with them. It can't be the times of genocide, of the extermination of an entire people, can't return before our eyes, before our passivity. If Palestine dies, humanity dies, and we'll not let it die as we'll not let humanity die.
Gustavo Petro made the announcement during the International Workers' Day march in the capital, Bogota. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas reacted by hailing the decision as a victory for Palestinians and their cause. The movement also called on other South American nations to follow suit by severing all diplomatic relations with the fascist Israeli regime. Colombia has been a vocal critic of Israel's crimes in Gaza since the onset of the regime's genocide early last October. The South American country has expressed readiness to join South Africa's genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. Director of the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders, joined us earlier. She says the world's public opinion is turning against Israel as it considers the regime a pariah state that commits atrocious crimes across the Gaza Strip.
Across the world, Israel is seen as a pariah state, really a state that is committing enormous war crimes every day in full view of the world. Everyone has seen these videos. And for literally billions of people in the world today, they are demanding of their government to end all relations with the Zionist state of Israel. It's a courageous step that Colombia has taken, because it means that, again, they're in the U.S. crosshairs. Because who's responsible? Who really proposed and pushed the Abraham Accords? That was the U.S. They want countries around the world to recognize Israel, and they pushed for it. But now, all of that is being reversed.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hidden files. Well, it is hard to believe that we are still witnessing this Zionist Holocaust take place against the Palestinians in Gaza. How is it possible that 4% of the population in Gaza has been killed or injured? How is it possible that this is still going on? What happened to the leaders of the world? What happened to international law? These are questions that many people have been asking since the start of this genocide. Well, I'm Marzia Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files. And today we'll be talking to someone who has spent most of his life working in the field of international law and working for various international human rights organizations. Perhaps he can shed some light on the reasons we are still watching genocide in real time without it being forced to be stopped. But before we talk to our guests, let's take a look at this example of an Orwellian realm of doublethink that we recently saw from U.S. President Joe Biden, which is the root of the problem we're facing in countering this genocide.
What is your red line with Prime Minister Netanyahu? Do you have a red line? For instance, would invasion of Rafah, which you have urged him not to do, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if it crosses, and they cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead as a consequence of going after. There's other ways to deal, to get to deal with the with the trauma caused by Hamas. And it's like, look, the first time I went over, I sat with them and I sat with a war captain. I said, look, don't make the mistake.
Well, as mind-boggling as that is, it is the reality coming out of Washington when dealing with the Israeli regime. Well, I'd like to bring in our guest now who may be able to explain to us how we got here and why has international law failed the people of Palestine.
Alfred Morris de Zayas is an American lawyer, writer, historian, and expert in the field of human rights and international law, a retired high-ranking United Nations official, a peace activist, and since 2012, the United Nations independent expert on the promotion of democratic and equitable international order, also known as Special Rapporteur, appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council. He is a retired senior lawyer with the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and former Secretary of the Human Rights Committee and Chief of the Petitions Section.
Well, welcome to Hidden Files, Alfred Maurice de Zayas. I mean, many lawyers and activists say that the International Criminal Court is indifferent to solving the case of the crimes against Palestinians. I mean, what is the reason for the delay, and do you think that the Israeli lobby plays a role in any of this?
Of course it does, but it's worse than that. It's much worse than that. The ICC was established, if you want, as a weapon of the collective West. The ICC, from day one, has been in the service of Washington and Brussels. Even if Washington is not a member, Washington pulls the strings. And Washington bullies and threatens, etc., and sanctions. Why do I say that? Look at the various prosecutors. The only one who had a little bit of independence, not much, was Fatou Bensouda from the Gambia. And Fatou Bensouda started an investigation on crimes by NATO forces in Afghanistan and Iraq. Almost the first thing that her successor, the Brit, Karim Khan, one of the first things he does is to discontinue an investigation of war crimes by NATO forces, but continues the investigations against the Taliban. Well, what kind of court is that? You know, it's such an obvious politicization of a judicial institution. But again, since they have the power of the media, and since they have an enormous public relations budget, people still think that the International Criminal Court has some credibility. Now, the International Criminal Court has had to accept the case submitted by Algeria, Djibouti, and six countries concerning Netanyahu and the war crimes and crimes against humanity being committed in Israel. So this is a pending case before the International Criminal Court, and it's going to be difficult for Karim Khan to completely smother this case. He will try. He will delay it. He will try not to make any public statements because that goes against the interests of the collective West. But he cannot, it's just too public. He cannot, in this case, considering that more countries have joined Algeria in bringing this case to the ICC, it's not going to be easy for him to simply discontinue. What I could see happening, if he doesn't act in the next couple of months and he does not issue a warrant for the arrest of Benjamin Netanyahu, I could see a movement in Africa, in Asia, of countries that have understood that the ICC is in the service of Washington and Brussels, and they will withdraw from the Statute of Rome. I think the ICC cannot be reformed. I think the ICC is so corrupted, so infiltrated. Also, the staff. Who do you think gets appointed? Who do you think gets recruited? Even the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights today. Do you think that they would recruit me again?
Well, stay with us, Alfred. Stay with us, viewers. Let's take a quick look at a clip regarding South Africa and this change that is happening in the world in perspective towards the Israeli regime.
Well, of course, South Africa is hopeful. We've always approached this case in a positive spirit. But our core purpose was really that it is vital to highlight the plight of the innocent in Palestine, and to also alert the international community to the great harm that is being done to the people of Palestine, to public institutions, and to the general order in that area, and also draw attention to the lack of justice and freedom over many, many decades.
Well, thanks so much for staying with us. We continue our interview with Mr. Dezalis. Now, Alfred, South Africa recently filed a case against Israel in the International Court of Justice, and we've seen strong arguments supporting the Palestinian cause and claiming what is happening is genocide. What do you think the result of this court will be, and will it carry any legal weight, or what effect at the end of the day can it have?
Well, already, by way of perception of reality, this is a watershed that a country like South Africa dared to take on Israel before the International Court of Justice. That is big. And the fact that the South African lawyers did a magnificent job, I mean, I've read with amazement and admiration the legal brief presented to the International Court of Justice. And I heard the presentations on the 11th and 12th of January. And the International Court of Justice cannot backpedal on itself. It cannot overthrow the precedents that it already established in prior judgments. Take the judgment of Bosnia and Herzegovina against Serbia, and the finding that a single massacre, Srebrenica, constituted genocide. I mean, Srebrenica is nothing in comparison to what's going on right now. And in Srebrenica, it was also very difficult to establish intent. Article 2 of the Genocide Convention talks about intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, religious, linguistic group. Now, South Africa, pages 57 to 69 in the brief, documents systematically what Netanyahu has said as what is the purpose of this action. Netanyahu and the president of Israel and the minister of defense and generals of the Israeli defense forces, etc., etc. It is so well documented that you cannot claim that the intent is anything else but the destruction in whole or in part of this group. And you destroy that group not only by killing them, you destroy that group by destroying their means of subsistence. You destroy that group already by establishing a naval blockade and food cannot come in. You destroy that group by evicting them from their homes. You destroy that group by destroying their homes, by bombarding their homes. So, I mean, it's an open and shut case. It is genocide.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you were part of the Human Rights Council and that it was very different than it is today. I want to know about what happened, what brought about that change, and are you hopeful about the future of international law?
In the 1990s, there was a major change in the Secretariat. First of all, the office grew exponentially, and it was essentially flooded by lawyers and by economists, etc., educated in the United States and Great Britain. So even though some of them were Asians, some of them were Africans, essentially they were in the service of the West. They had been educated in the West. They had been indoctrinated in the West. And then that gets reflected in the reports that the office does. Because I've been a person for methodology all my life. And I've been a person who believes in this rule, audiatur et altera pars, you have to listen to all sides. You have to evaluate all of the evidence in order to reach a conclusion. That's not the case. The office takes a position a priori. They want to write a report against China. They don't want to go and find out what's happening in Tibet or in... they want to report against China. So don't expect miracles. And that can change, that will change, but only when, say, the Africans put their foot down and say, I want this perspective, this approach to human rights to be applied. And what has happened? There is, in the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, in the Human Rights Council, a tendency to move away from cooperation, move away from advisory services and technical assistance, and take a confrontational approach. I've seen that get worse and worse through the 1990s, the 2000s, the 2010s. What you have in the Human Rights Council is an arena of gladiators who are throwing knives at each other. You don't have an atmosphere of dialogue. You don't have an atmosphere of cooperation. You have people condemning others. So naming and shaming. That is what the Human Rights Council does. It does not try to help the population in a given country. It tries to sow defame and discredit the government of that country in the hope that the country will fall and that you will have regime change. So this has been a strategy since the collapse of the Soviet Union to impose the Western perspective on everything.
Well, when you say to impose the Western perspective on everything, what do you mean exactly? How does that play out?
To impose it on everybody, and those countries that do not play the game are then targeted for regime change. Classical example, the memo back in the years of George W. Bush, when General Wesley Clark was shocked to learn that it had been decided in the Pentagon that we, the United States, were going topple seven governments. The document said we're going to take down seven governments: Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, Libya, etc. The idea was we're just going to install our puppets in these countries and we're going to make them into democracies. And of course, you have to watch it. Every time we use the word democracy, we don't mean democracy. We don't have democracy in the United States. What we mean is capitalism. What we mean is the type of economic capitalism that works for the elite in the United States and for the elite in the United Kingdom, etc. That is what democracy means, nothing else. But in any event, this marriage of politics and the media is such that you have a population in the United States and the United Kingdom and France that actually believes the propaganda. It takes a certain temerity to jump over the whole thing, as I say, to jump over your own shadow and to realize that you've been lied to. You've been lied to systematically. You've been lied to all your life. And it was not different before. I mean, people used to be lied to by governments all the time, but now they're more effective.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Dezayas, and hopefully we'll see how all of this plays out, and hopefully it plays out more positive with the situation in Palestine. Thank you, viewers, so much for staying with us. I'd like to bring in my colleague right now, Maryam Azacher.
Well, thank you for that, Marzia. Now, we have watched day in and day out for months this genocide taking place. It's heart-wrenching what is happening to the Palestinians in Gaza. The glimmer of hope, though, comes first from the resistance itself and then from the growing awareness globally about the reality of the Israeli regime. As more countries, especially many from the global south, are standing up and condemning the Palestinian Holocaust, there is hope that there can be a new international system which will replace the current one. As we have heard on this program, there is a need for an alternative global system, one which is not based on colonialism nor hegemonic interests, but a representative system that the world's people will be treated as if all lives matter, not just a privileged few.
Well, thank you, Maryam, for that. And we can only hope that we can see an alternative system soon. But in the meantime, let us just keep praying for the people of Palestine and do whatever we can to stop the genocide now. I'm Marzia Hashemi, thanking all of you for joining us right here on Hidden Files. Goodbye. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
collection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the firstest of brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت القرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters and all of our listeners. Welcome to the show, The Keys of Life, where we discuss the book Mafatihul Hayat, which means the keys of life, by Ayatollah Jawadi Amili, in which we discuss different techniques, different advices that the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt have given us to make our lives better, to have a better life, as the name of the show is. And so far we've discussed many different topics. The topics, for example, that we discussed is how we should behave with believers, how we should be compassionate towards them, and there's been a lot of practical advice that has been provided. We've also discussed topics related to how we should be with those who transgress, those who are sinners, and how we should behave with them. Now finally, we come to a part of the book where the discussion takes on the hypocrites, the munafiqeen, as the word in Arabic is, and how we should be with those who hold this sort of hypocrisy within their hearts. Now, of course, we've been told to stay away from hypocrites, right? But sometimes it can be difficult for us to identify who is a hypocrite or not, because they're showing themselves as believers. When you speak to them, as the Quran says in Surah Munafiqun, when you speak to them, you might actually like what they have to say. However, in this book, through the sayings of the Ahlul Bayt, they have provided us with signs of how we can identify who a hypocrite may be. So some of the qualities of a hypocrite have been mentioned here. So I'll go through some of these qualities so that we all become familiar with those who are hypocrites. And also, if we have any hypocrisy within us, then we should try to remove it as well from within our hearts. So, of course, the first quality that's mentioned here is that they claim to have faith within them while these people are lying, right? Now, this may not always be easy to identify. However, as we go along and we look at the different qualities, we'll see how this actually plays out into a person's personality. When a person is lying about their faith, there'll be certain things which will come up which identify those traits within them. So, for example, one of the traits that's mentioned here is that these people are extremely afraid of death, and it's not the normal sort of fear of death that we're talking about here that many human beings may have. But for example, when they're called to, God says in the Holy Quran, you know, when they're called for jihad, for a holy war, then, you know, at that time, these people, they turn their backs. You know, they'll start making excuses. They will be afraid of going to war because they're afraid for their lives. So this is one of the signs of a hypocrite. Another sign is that they will find excuses, that they will, you know, they'll try to sort of shy away from the responsibilities when times are difficult. And God says, you know, these people, they might be trying to fool the rest of us, but they're not able to fool God himself. Now, in the world that we live in today, of course, this is an extremely important topic from maybe not only just from an individual point of view, but even from, let's say, a political point of view. You know, many times people are confused by the way certain countries behave, how certain politicians may behave, how certain groups among us may behave. And these traits that we're mentioning, they will help us identify when someone is being hypocritical or not. One of these traits which is related to this is that when someone is hypocritical or is a hypocrite, they want to cooperate with the enemy, right? They'll say things like, you know, we need to make peace with the enemy. We need to find ways to, like, you know, get along with our enemies. And all the time when they're calling for peace, the enemies, they're planning against them, right? They're planning against the believers. So one of the signs of the hypocrites that's mentioned here is that, you know, they want to cooperate. They want to work with the enemies of Islam. And one of the things that's mentioned here is that, you know, these people, they also start identifying people of different classes, right? For example, in the Holy Quran, you know, when it was said to some of these people, you know, you should come and believe, you know, become a believer, they would sometimes say, should we become believers like those that are poor among us, right? Should we become like them? So someone who's a hypocrite, you know, they will sometimes feel that they're better than, for example, someone who has less than them in society. And this is really talking about from an economical point of view. You know, the Quran says, is this how you're going to behave? That is this how you're going to identify faith, is by, for example, somebody's economic or class level. So sometimes we see that among us, that there are people, they behave a certain way, for example, someone who's wealthy, and they'll behave a certain way with someone who's not as wealthy. And this is one of the signs of hypocrisy within someone. Someone who's a believer, they will behave, you know, in the same manner towards everyone, regardless of what their status level is in society. They will treat people not based on their, you know, how much money they have, but on more other real factors. So let's just go for a quick break, and then we will come back and speak about more of the qualities of a hypocrite.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree,
امام همونطوری که این رو گفته بارم گفته دی اون امامشو گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
So welcome back, and we have been discussing the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life by Ayatollah Javadi Amini. And the topic we've been discussing today is related to hypocrisy, or munafiqun. You know, who are these people that are hypocrites and what are their traits? One of the traits that's mentioned here is laziness and or, you know, showing off when it comes to obedience or to worship to God. When someone has hypocrisy in them, they will be lazy when it comes to doing worship of God. Here it says, you know, that they don't actually really even believe in God. And so therefore, that causes laziness in them. And even when they do worship, it's only done to show other people. It's either to sort of appease other people, or it's to show off to other people, to show, oh, look, look at me, I'm worshiping, I'm praying, I'm spending the night, you know, doing all this worship. When in reality, this person doesn't really remember God. They're not really doing it for the sake of God. They're really only doing it for themselves and to show off. So this is something I think that we should all be careful of, that we don't become lazy when it comes to worship, that we don't, you know, do worship for the sake of showing off to others, which is a sin on its own, and it's also a sign of hypocrisy. Another sign mentioned here of hypocrisy is that a hypocrite makes fun of believers, right? They make fun of their beliefs, they make fun of maybe how they are behaving, and this is something that we should be really careful of and we should avoid doing as well. You know, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said to his companion Kumail that keep away from hypocrites, don't go where they are, don't attend their gatherings, don't do business with them, try to stay away from them as much as possible, you know, don't listen to them, don't obey them. Thank you so much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of truth, hear the children scream.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
U.S. police storm several colleges and arrest more students as unrest over Israel's onslaught against Palestinians in Gaza simmer on campuses. A major Muslim civil rights and advocacy group censures U.S. lawmakers for approving a bill aimed at criminalizing any criticism of Israel. And an international human rights organization says Israel militarizes schools in Gaza, executing displaced people who seek refuge there. Hello and welcome, everybody. Anti-Israel protests are gaining momentum on U.S. campuses as more and more university students are standing in solidarity with Palestinians. Scuffles broke out between pro-Palestinian protesters and police at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. Also, protesters have camped in the University of California, Los Angeles. Police ordered them to leave their encampment or face arrest. However, hundreds remained inside, putting on helmets, masks, and goggles at New York's